Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another great webinar here at the FIAT Group. We're very excited. Our topic today is pretty long, the title. It's top misuse employers make when it comes to the health plan, ... and what we can all do to become health plan heroes. I consider myself a health plan hero, Ron. What about you?
Well, let's become health plan superheroes, Adam.
Right, let's do it. So today, we're really excited about this. There's a lot of stuff. The reason we brought this topic up is there is so much going on right now in the industry where we're just seeing it's those moments. Like, why do they do that moment? It's like, I can't believe it. Over and over and over again. So as always, with me is our Senior VP and General Counsel, Ron Peck. Say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
Back by popular demand. I'm going to skip the fine lady here. I'm going to skip her for a second. But back by popular demand, we set records, with the number of people that have asked us to have Brady come back. So even though Ron and I were like, we don't think he's quite ready for this yet, we said, okay, we're going to give this kid an opportunity. So say hello, Brady.
Hello, Brady.
Brady's one of our staff attorneys here. And for those you don't know, he next week at the Texas Association of Benefit Administrators, TABA, next Tuesday, I believe, Brady will be doing his first live presentation to the self-assured industry. I try to make him as nervous as possible for this. I did. I said, listen, this is a hostile audience out there.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to want to find ways to rip you apart. I mean, you're going to be compared to Ron, the non-comparable Ron Peck. But you have a lot to live up to. So we're excited that Brady's speaking today. As you guys all know, he is our Trump expert. He's our White House expert. He doesn't sleep. He's waiting for those tweets at 4:30 in the morning from the president himself. And last but not least is our VP of Consulting, the wonderful, the bright, the energetic, and just a great speaker as well, Jennifer McCormick. Say hello, Jen.
Hello.
So with that, I want to make sure everyone knows, as always, please, today for this webinar, you can send us questions. As you know, if we see a good question, we're going to stop the webinar right in its tracks and answer that question if we think it makes sense compared to what we're talking about. Or we'll wait to the end, or if we run out of time, which happens a lot, we will just reach out to you after the webinar is over and give you an answer or discuss it over the phone or in a webinar or whatever it might be. Just so you know, as always, all these questions, all these miscues that we're going to talk about today, most of them originate, most of them are founded from first being contacted here at FIA at PGC Referral is the big email, pgcreferral@fiagroup.com. is where most of these miscues start. It's when we get that random email, hey, Jen, I'm sure you've never seen this before. Or, hey, Brady, I'm sure you've heard this question 10,000 times. So far this month, in the first 15 days, we've had 1,630 emails sent to PGC Referral. So we're seeing what those issues are. And in a minute, Jen is actually going to talk about what some of those issues that we've been seeing, what the most frequently asked questions were in January of 2017. But before we get into that, I know Jen has something she wants to talk about, and it's our new flagship plan document. I know, Jen, you weren't a big fan of the word flagship. Ron and I love it. Okay, so folks, if you want to chime in on what you think, she's like, Adam, it's our best practices plan doc, so why don't we just call it our best practices plan doc? And I said, Ron said, because that'd be too easy. We have to call it the flagship. What we're doing, our goal on this is basically – I want to start it off, Jen, if you don't mind.
No,
the whole point of creating our plan doc with all the different options in the software was to have so many choices. You're a TPA. You want to be customized. You don't want to be like the Blue Crosses and the Uniteds, like in the ASO world, where everything is one standard template. You want to have 75 different definitions for a term. And then what we realized is some of you don't want 75. You don't want 7. You don't want 2. You want one.
Tell me what to do.
You tell me what to do.
Right.
So basically what we did is we were able to take that checklist and create it based on our plan doc, the one that we are actually on, the one my wife and my 4 kids are on, the one Ron's 1 kid is on. All of us. Is your kid on our plan?
Oh, yeah.
See, all right.
This is the best plan in the country.
That is true. That is true. But I wanted to make sure that everyone understood. We basically did that. So, Jen, you want to share the details on this? And where our goal was to have this put into our plan doc management software by June. That is the goal. I know Jen's looking at me with the crazy eyes. But that is the goal, to have it by the time we have our forum in June. But you want to talk to the folks what this is about?
Yeah, so the reason that this came into fruition is over the past couple of years, we have been and we do recognize the value of being self-funded, and so that you can design and customize benefits for the employees that specifically match whatever it is that you want to offer. You can have a tailored plan document tailored to your employee population. However, over the course of a number of years now, we've gotten a lot of questions. Well, these are great custom options. These are great options. There's a lot of variables here. Why is it that you have 10 work comp exclusion options for me to pick from when I'm trying to decide? I've never been self-funded before. Tell me what to do. What do people in the industry do? What's the best choice? So taking all of our recommendations, reviewing our own plan documents we offer to our own employees, we took it upon ourselves to create our best practices template that we can offer to people who are asking what it is that we would pick or what options we would select if we wanted to have a template that is reflective of all the best cost-containing options there are in the industry right now.
So basically, Jen, you're saying all they have to do on a plan on this flagship, not best practice, but flagship plan, is put in a schedule of benefits and identify what the eligibility criteria is. Obviously, employer info, you know, but that's it.
There are very limited things that exactly that you have to do. You have to have the basic information that you'd have for any plan, the name of the plan, the tax ID number, the address, basic information with phone numbers, a few couple of exclusions if you have benefit variations, but it is a significantly limited, condensed version of our template. So this is the best choice for any employer who is looking to have mass-produced documents that take into consideration our best practices, but they want it done fast and efficiently.
And this can be turned around in how long?
10 business days.
Perfect. So if somebody wants to obviously reach out to Tim Callender, you see his information on the bottom. Tim, as you all know, is our VP of Sales and Marketing. And with that, we're going to go over to the next slide. Jen, let's talk about the most frequently asked questions. We're going to try to limit Jen to 5 minutes on this. She likes to go overboard here. But real quick, yes, this webinar is being recorded, folks. You will be able to have access to this webinar literally tomorrow or today on our website. In addition, as you all know, we've been starting our Empowering Plans podcast. We do those every 2 weeks. Episode 2 just got done and published. I believe it was put out there live on Monday. So feel free to reach out to our website and check out our podcast as well. Jen, what are the most frequently asked questions?
Okay, so this goes back to our best practices template. I'm sorry, our flagship template. Just kidding, that was not a slip. All right, so what is our confined persons exclusion? This is a question that has come in, and it does relate back to our best practices template. So why would someone want to have this within their plan document, and why would you want to include a time frame? Well, the answer to that is this confined persons exclusion, or similar to this, are for individuals who would be able to have something in their plan to exclude benefits that would be incurred while someone was confined while in jail or while in prison. So we understand that there might be the possibility that someone, maybe a kid or a daughter, a son, would maybe go to the sober tank for an evening, and maybe they were only there for 12 hours and they didn't want any claims that had incurred if they had fallen down or slipped to be excluded under the plan while they were confined for a short time period while in jail. And this exclusion, with that caveat for the time frame, is allowing the plan to cover those small incidental claims that might have arisen while someone was in the drunk tank. Not that that would happen to anyone, but just in case it did, the plan...
This personal experience that Jen has. Clearly. She knows about this confined person exclusion extremely much. I mean, I just noticed that. Did you guys not notice that?
All right, next. Will plan's grandfather status be impacted if a plan modifies their prescription drug coverage to include a requirement to use generics when available and when medically appropriate? And the answer is generally no. It is not our interpretation that if you are suggesting that people use generics when they are available and when they are medically appropriate, that would change or cause them to lose their grandfather status for the plans that are still out there that still do have grandfather status. This is something that is recognized under the FAQs as we currently know them to exist right now, and also something that is encouraged. We do want to encourage people to ensure that they can contain costs when appropriate and use generics. The next question is about the 1095C forms and the employer mandate reporting and whether or not there's any transition relief that's available and about the affordability safe harbors and whether they're still applicable. So it is true that in the past couple of years, some ALEs, or applicable large employers, had qualified for multiple forms of relief. So those reliefs have changed from year to year, but it's important to note that the 2016 calendar year, there is still some relief for non-calendar year plans. And also, as far as the safe harbors are concerned, there are the three safe harbors that have been in effect and that still are in effect, specifically the W-2 wages, the rate of pay, and the FPL, or the federal poverty line. And just as a quick reminder, when we're talking about our forms, the ALE requirement for the 1094 Cs and the 1095 Cs for 2016, your paper filing is due by February 28th of 2017, which is in 2 weeks. And the electronic filing is March 31st. So you have about 6 weeks for that. And I'll turn it back over to Adam.
Thank you. Hey, Jeff, you're speaking at SPBA, right? Soon? Is it next month? Who is speaking there next month?
I'm not sure.
I think John.
Tim?
Oh, Tim and John Javelin are, right?
Yes.
They're tying to a lot of these things, which is great. Real quick, we had a couple of questions in regards to the flagship plan doc. Yes, you can purchase it. You can customize it. It is available in Word form. No question. And in regards to cost, can you purchase the template, et cetera? Just reach out to Jen McCormick or to Tim Callender for all those details. Obviously, a lot of it depends on, you know, how much customization and what you're looking for specifically. But we appreciate the interest already. Real quick, as many of you know, we're doing everything we possibly can to promote LinkedIn and Twitter and also our Passion for Subro blog. There have been thousands, tens of thousands of you who've actually viewed many of the comments and blog posts that we have had recently, which is great. We appreciate it. But as always, every month, visit our pages, post some honest feedback of how badly you think Jen has been doing on these webinars, and you'll get 1 hour of free consultative guidance from our folks here at FIA Group. But obviously, every day, Brady's putting a lot of stuff in there in regards to what's going on in D.C. Ron is putting a lot of information down there from a legal and regulatory standpoint, as well as a cost containment standpoint. I'm putting a lot of personal information on there as what we're seeing in the industry. Had a lot of very interesting insights from being at the NAHU conference earlier this week in D.C., just getting insight as to what the brokers are seeing, what they're thinking or not thinking about as we go to 2017 as well. So please feel free to reach out to us for that. Real quick, on the overview, in the 46 minutes we have available, we're going to talk about the Trump transition update and what an amazing 3 weeks it's been so far, huh, folks?
It's been busy.
It's been busy. There's no question. We're going to talk about some gaps. Folks, the gap is not just between the plan document and the stop-loss policy. We obviously know there are a lot of gaps there, okay? But what we've been asked a lot about recently is specifically related to the employee handbook, the leave of absence provisions specifically. A lot of people are looking at these handbooks. More and more stop-loss carriers are using the employee handbook as a reason for a potential denial because the person wasn't eligible for coverage in the first place. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the unwritten rules in the gap, looking at the plan doc versus the vendor's a vendor's policy or contract, then looking at the old standby, the FPD versus the stop-loss contract. Folks, again, most stop-loss contracts have things in them that can allow them to deny a claim. Not a problem. That's in the contract. You might be okay with it. But the most important thing for the employers is that they're aware of where the gaps are. Last but not least, the gap, and I know Brady has a lot of insight on this as well, is what does the plan doc say versus what the law is? That is a gap too. Too often we hear, well, the plan doc says this. Yeah, but it's illegal. So I don't care if you say it in the plan. It's still illegal. But for now, we're going to turn it all over. Why is everyone saying I'm picking on Jen? I don't think that's happening. Anyway, we're going to turn it over to Brady to discuss the Trump transition update. Brady, have some fun.
Thanks, Adam. There's a lot to cover in this section. But before I do, Jen is just dying to chime in with something. So, Jen, take over for a sec.
There's very few times where I'm allowed to talk. So the only things that I quickly wanted to talk about, which relate to the Trump transition, is that this morning, CMS has released some new proposals about the Affordable Care Act, specifically about the individual insurance exchanges. So it's important that if you haven't been looking at your emails or haven't seen the news, that you should pay attention to these new, first, massive changes to Obamacare or ACA as we currently know it to be. One of the things that's most significant about the proposed changes are cutting the enrollment time in half down to 90 days, I believe, or 60 days instead. And this is going to have a big impact potentially, and one of the reasons behind this limited enrollment is, or the theory behind it, is that you are going to have fewer people who are enrolling just because they get sick. and that they are going to be paying attention and people are going to have to make this choice before they get sick and potentially impacting the pool of individuals who would be eligible to sign up for coverage. The other thing that is significant to note here, too, is that there are going to be harsher proof of eligibility standards and a more intense process that is going to be looked into when people are going to be switching coverage onto potentially an exchange plan because maybe they lost coverage under their employer or there was a change in situation. So there's going to be tougher protocols to keep in mind. So this is the first big change that has occurred. So it's going to be important to realize that stuff is starting to happen. So we need to pay attention and see how this is potentially going to have an impact on our self-funded plans. Sorry, Brady.
No problem. Thanks, Jen. So yeah, I mean, as you can tell, there's a lot going on. If you're following the news, it seems every single day there's breaking news about something to do with the Trump administration. He's tweeting left and right, but we've done our best here for you to keep on top of the developments. And you may have noticed that last Friday we saw Tom Price finally sworn in as the new Secretary of Health and Human Services. He had a bit of a rocky process in place, some ethics questions, but they got through it. He is now leading the charge. He's leading a $1 trillion budget in his department. He is going to be leading the FDA and the NIH and the CDC. It's a big role, and he'll be leading the charge to repeal and replace Obamacare. So we'll be keeping an eye on him closely to see what he comes up with, but we know that it'll be a rocky road going forward. So what's happened? Well, we started out with repeal and replace, and anyone who watched the Super Bowl, you may have caught that President Trump had an interview with Bill O'Reilly where he sort of extended the timeline into potentially next year for getting repeal and replace done. And the new word that we've heard within the last week even is repeal, replace, and repair. There was a summit that Republican lawmakers met in Philadelphia on a few weeks ago, and someone leaked some audio. Leaks have been a big thing in the news lately, if you haven't noticed. One of them was leaked audio that revealed that there's actually more division among Republicans than we publicly realized. They understand that potentially 20 million people could lose coverage after a full repeal, and so they want to be sure that whatever they come up with, it's going to be called Trump Care. They're going to own it, and they want to make sure that it's done right. But this kind of infighting is not really a good sign for the timeline involved here, and we can expect that it'll take probably a lot longer going forward to get a replacement bill in place. So some of the details about the biggest issues that are facing the Congress, and keep in mind here, I mean, these are not just policy discussions or theories. In certain cases, people's lives depend on the answers to these questions, and people with pre-existing conditions, for example, or who are dependent on the Medicaid expansion. So that's a big deal. And also, keep in mind as well that time is of the essence. Insurance companies have about 3 more months to decide what kinds of policies, if any, they're going to sell to the public in 2018. So they're listening for answers, and Congress is really crunched on getting something to them. But the major areas that we're looking at, that they're looking at, rather, first of all, the future of Medicare and Medicaid. It looks like Medicare is moving further away from a fee-for-service model, more to a capitation model where you have a contract with a health plan, with the insurance company, with the state to provide sort of more managed care, more coordinated care. That should help keep costs down. But Medicaid's the real big one. A lot of people are covered by Medicaid, by the expansion in the states. I attended an event a few weeks ago in Massachusetts where we discussed the future of the ACA and the impact it would have. And I can tell you that one of the big concerns is that, you know, the federal government gave a lot of money to the states to provide coverage for Medicaid enrollees, and there's a concern that that money may be taken back. It may be redeployed in the form of a block grant. And some of you may know that block grants tend to dry up over time, that there's a lot of strings attached. So there's a concern on that. The second big issue that they're going to be dealing with is pre-existing conditions. I mean, what happens to people who have cancer or AIDS or other chronic illnesses who were previously relying on health insurance? Will that requirement continue under the Trump administration? He said that he wants to keep it, but as many of you know, it's very expensive to keep that, and you need to have healthy people in the risk pool to offset the cost of providing those who are sick with care. As Jen mentioned, there are some new rules just today we just looked at where enrollment periods are being tweaked to sort of prevent the problem of people just signing up when they get sick and causing, you know, potential disaster. But from a standpoint of polling, most Americans like this provision of the ACA, so we can expect that some version of this will probably remain in whatever the replacement bill looks like. The next big issue we're looking here is taxes and fees. So as many of you know, the ACA came with very many taxes as part of the bill. And there's a division between the House and the Senate about what to do. The Republicans in the Senate, they want to keep some of the revenue that's been collected because that revenue is helping to provide subsidies for low-income individuals who are relying on subsidized care. And the House Republicans want to get rid of all the taxes. I mean, not surprising. And the leadership in the House is also sort of towing that line. So there's a division there. I think in the end We'll have some of the taxes kept, some won't be kept. The medical device tax, I think that's an unpopular one. And so, of course, for many employers, of course, is the Cadillac tax. So we do expect that'll be, if not removed entirely, it'll definitely be reworked. And so we can expect that less money will be coming into federal coffers, which means that less money will be going out to provide subsidies for care going forward. So finally, the big issue they have to rely on is transition and timing. As I mentioned in a recent interview, President Trump said that maybe this will take till sometime next year, but he wants to have the rudiments in place by the end of this year. But how much time do we expect to see between a repeal bill and a replacement bill? A repeal bill, while Republicans have the ability to defund parts of the ACA through the budget process, they're going to need 60 votes in the Senate to actually repeal legislatively the parts of the ACA that were passed originally under President Obama. So when that's done, is it going to be a six-month delay? Is it going to be a smooth transition? We're not sure. And, of course, if federal spending is involved, which you can bet that it will be involved, what will the federal regulations look like? So what services will be required to be covered? Maternity care, for example, mental health services, substance abuse treatment. Will these things continue, or will the federal government drop these regulations? One of Trump's mantras has been that he wants to eliminate, every one regulation put in place, he wants to get rid of two or three. So if you take into account that he's looking to get rid of regulations, you can bet that a lot of the federal coverage mandates may go away. But we're not sure. And, we'll be watching this day to day and, literally from tweet to tweet in certain cases. And I think, though, and this is February, it's a crucial month. We just got the secretary confirmed. I think you'll start to see a lot more movement. As I mentioned, you've got about 3 months for insurance companies to be able to tell what they're going to be able to offer. And so we're going to have answers definitely by the summer, a lot more than we have now.
Expect a lot more webinars in regards to this stuff.
There's certainly
by May or June.
Yes, absolutely. There's certainly more to say on this. And as Jen mentioned, today was the first official rule change that they've announced. And recall as well, the president signed within hours of taking office the executive order, which basically directed agencies to, loosen enforcement and to, I think it was quote unquote, minimize the impact on private insurers and on employers. So, we know the theme going forward, but we'll see the details be filled in more and more going along.
Now, as we get into the next slide, I know, Jen, you're going to be talking about some of the details here. What this is all about, folks, just so you know, what we've noticed is, again, more and more issues coming up with language differences between two separate documents. The first one we're going to talk about is the Plan Doc versus the Employee Handbook, and there are three major areas of concern, Jen, that you mentioned. Okay, before we get into it, can you pick which one is the biggest that you're seeing an issue with right now of the three?
Yeah, obviously it's a leave of absence. This has been the biggest area of concern, gap, failure to get reimbursed by a carrier, failure of misunderstanding between employees and employers. It's the biggest pitfall.
So we're going to go into that last, but we can start off with eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
But I really want to make sure we spend a lot of time on that one, leave of absence, because you're talking about how it's just overwhelming. It's like when you say that it's the most, multiple TPAs are coming to you with this every single day. Is that what we're seeing?
Yeah,
one or two carriers or?
Multiple questions, multiple types of leaves of absence. Leave of absence is not FMLA only. It is much broader than that. So it is sad, but it's good that we are talking about it now, that we are only seeing the reactions to having these gaps, to having these pitfalls, to having these provisions in the plan that don't line up. So it'd be great if there was a way to proactively address that, which we'll get to shortly.
So let's talk about eligibility first then.
Okay.
Get this one out of the way.
Eligibility. This is an easy one to clear up. So when we're talking about the plan doc versus the employee handbook, we're looking at it in terms of the eligibility. There are a couple examples, but when you're looking at your employee handbook, as we do from year to year, the employee handbook is going to define what parameters, what the classifications are for your employees as an employer. So maybe you have part-time employees, maybe you have different classes of employees. In addition to identifying what the eligibility requirements are to be an employee, your employee handbook probably is going to identify the different types of benefits that the employer offers as employer coverage. So medical coverage, dental coverage, vision coverage. And it's very possible that since both the employee handbook and the plan document identify eligibility criteria, that it could vary. It's possible that your plan document, and for medical benefits, the eligibility is 30 hours in line with ACA today, but for dental coverage, the employee has to work 35 hours per week. Or for vision coverage, you have to work 40 hours per week, and it's only eligible for employees, not employees independent. So not only is there a potential gap between the employee handbook and the plan document that needs to be addressed for eligibility of who actually is entitled to the benefits themselves, but realize that there is potentially different criteria based on the type of employee you are and the type of benefits that you're eligible for.
So, Jen, real quick, in regards to eligibility, is it normal that someone reaches out to us before they have a problem and ask us to look to see if there's a problem? Or is it, hey, are we having a claim denied here?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's always the latter, that we're looking at this from a reacting point of view as opposed to being proactive about it. And there's not necessarily, this is a newer concept that people are actually now starting to look at the employee handbook and realize that there are contradictions in there. And you'd be surprised at the handbooks that we have seen that haven't been updated for a number of years. And in addition,
so people are updating their plan,
but not their handbook. So maybe their handbook had eligibility criteria when the plan was in place in 2008, when it was a fully insured plan, but not in 2017 when they have made all these modifications for ACA.
And we apologize for the folks that are asking us to slow down a little. We are in Boston, so we are actually speaking very slow, just so you know. We are. This is as slow as we've ever spoken. The minute we walk out of here, it's a different level, so we apologize. But let's go to the disability, Jen. What do we see there?
Yeah, so the thing about disability that is key is that what does disability mean? Are we talking about a disability leave? Are we talking about short-term disability? Are we talking about long-term disability? Are we talking about another type of disability? So oftentimes we see documents where there is an employee handbook that says, if you're out on lowercase disability leave, we'll continue your coverage as an employer. There's nothing about that in the plan document. So what are you supposed to do if you're an employer? Does that mean that the employer then has the obligation to offer COBRA? Well, the plan document doesn't say so, and if you do that, you're going to be contradicting the terms of the plan document, or if you offer in the, not COBRA coverage, but continuation of other coverage. That would not be necessarily something that you'd want to be in the position of having to consider how to handle. So when you're talking about disability, if disability leave is something that is available or that the employer offers, make sure that the handbook actually reflects what it is the employer wants to do when it comes to continuing coverage. Whether or not they want to continue coverage is the first step. And then if you do, making sure it matches the plan document is the second step.
Before we turn it over to Ron, can I ask you one more question?
Yeah.
Compared to last year at this time, how many more inquiries are we seeing relating to the handbook issue that we saw at this point last year? Is this a trend that is...
This is a trend, and, you know, we might be partially to blame because we are making people start to pay attention to this, because before we started talking about this and getting these issues, people weren't paying attention to it, and that was part of the problem. So I think that we are creating a good topic of discussion for people to realize, but this has been on the increase in the number of questions and inquiries we are getting, and I can't wait to actually get proactive requests for us to be able to handle that. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ron.
All right. Hi, everybody. It's not Valentine's Day anymore, but I can turn it down and slow it down a little bit for you. So, it's funny because as we're talking about this, first of all, incredible turnout. Thank you very much for the number of people who have dialed in today. It's apparent to me and I think everybody else here that we've, I think, really touched on a sore spot for a lot of people. This is clearly a topic that interests a lot of those in the industry that work with us and tune in. And I don't know about you, but I certainly miss the old days. In the old days, the problem was that some employee who was on the plan, they'd be terminated or they'd quit, and technically they should have been kicked from the plan, and the employer just forgot to tell their broker or forgot to tell the TPA. And so the claims keep coming in, and the person is still covered by the plan. And then when they find out, whoops, we forgot to tell you that we fired them, and now we've got an overpayment, and now we're trying to get the money back from the provider. But at least everybody knew that that person wasn't supposed to be on the plan, and it was just a matter of somebody forgetting to tell the TPA to remove them from plan enrollment. The problem here is now we're talking about a situation where the employer doesn't even realize that they've made a mistake. And we're talking about, you know, leaves of absence, eligibility, disability, as if they're three issues. But really, they all kind of have the same foundational core problem, which is that we don't have the same people developing the same policies. An individual who is, let's say, disabled, one individual at the employer's organization may say, oh, yeah, this person, they're entitled to short-term disability. They're entitled to long-term disability. Go ahead and provide them with disability coverage. in their mind, they think that that means a full gamut of coverage. They don't realize that they're just talking about income supplementation, not health benefits. But there's this assumption that if somebody's on disability, that the health plan naturally extends. Not so. But that's one decision maker. A completely different decision maker is looking at the person, and they're deciding who's eligible for coverage under the plan, who isn't, you know, a full-time employee, someone who's working this many hours. That's the individual who's talking to the broker. That's the individual that's talking to the TPA, and that's the individual that's deciding whether to adopt the plan document as written. Then you've got a third individual who's looking at somebody who needs to take a leave of absence. Maybe this is someone else in HR, and they're saying, oh, yeah, you're approved for your leave of absence. Maybe they're looking at what the law requires. The problem is that you have three different individuals talking about these three issues that in reality is one of the same issue, which is that there's not a matching sort of cohesiveness between the documents. And really, you're serving four masters if you think about it, right? You've got the plan document, which is telling the fiduciary as the plan administrator, this is who you have to cover. This is when you have to cover them. Then you have a handbook, and this handbook is binding on the employer. Not the plan administrator, but the employer, right? It's a contract. This is what's covered. This is what's not. This is what we provide. Then you've got stop loss, who's looking at the plan, and they're saying that anyone who's not covered in accordance with this plan shouldn't be covered at all. And then last but not least, you have the law. And this is the most recent issue, and this is something that Adam was talking about, which is that you all of these documents, all of these rules need to comply with the law. So, again, how do you get everything to match? How do you get everything cohesive? You need to, A, make sure that your policies match with the legal requirements, and then once you've done that, review everything to make sure that they match and you close those gaps. I'm pleased to tell you that we are working on developing a solution. Certainly, you should reach out to us in the meantime to make sure that this is not a problem for you. Certainly, those of you who have had this issue have not been shy about reaching out to us. Everything we've talked about today is based on real experiences. If you think we're talking about you, maybe we are, but chances are we're not. Everybody seems to be suffering from the same problem.
So the bottom line is we will have an actual service related to the leave of absence provisions on a flat fee basis, just to make sure that all of you have an actual answer as to how much it's going to cost and so forth. But, Ron, we have a bunch of questions I want to make sure we try to respond to before we get into the next slide on the unwritten rules. First is, can you have a disclaimer in the handbook talking about if there's any discrepancy, one, the handbook or the SPD, one rules over the other? Does the SPD always win? If there's discrepancy, you're noticing now people are asking, are there simple, easy ways to get out of this when there is a discrepancy between an SPD and a handbook? Even ask questions of, hey, let's have one document that's both. So can you guys care to answer some of these questions for me?
Yeah, so remember the key thing here, too. What's the handbook? Is the employer's book for the employees who are employees of the employer.
Right, so it's of the company. It's rules for the company.
Right.
The employee benefit plan is a separate entity.
Correct.
Right.
It's the two different entities.
Right.
So you can have plenty of employees that are never on the plan.
Right.
And there are dependents on the plan that aren't employees.
Right.
So it's two separate distinct organizations. The FIA group company and the FIA group employee benefit plan are two very different things.
Adam, this issue keeps coming up, all right? First of all, this was the problem with the PPO contract, where the employer is signing a PPO contract, the plan document says something different, and then we're being told, well, doesn't the plan document trump the network contract? Meanwhile, you've got the provider in the network saying the plan could pay what the plan document
even
says.
When we,
the employer owes me the money.
We literally have nothing about networks in here, and Ron still finds a way to bring it up.
And I'll hit sub row too. Remember Walmart v. Schenck?
Right.
Walmart, the health plan, was pursuing its subrogation rights in that case, and yet everybody was dragging Walmart, the employer, over the coals, saying that they were greedy for taking this woman's money when they were two separate entities. So whether we're talking about networks, we're talking about subrogation, or we're talking about this lack of acceptance that the employer and the plan are two separate entities, they need to coordinate because it comes from the same pool of funds, but contractually they're two separate entities.
So, Jen, can we get back to now, all right, we want two separate documents.
Mm-hmm.
Can you have a disclaimer in there that one rules over the other?
Yeah, you can, but it's not necessarily going to have any impact. Because if you have a disclaimer that your SPD, for example, is going to rule over any discrepancy that there might be in the handbook, that just means that everything that's in your employee handbook is not going to be effective.
Right.
So that could potentially be a problem if you're promising employees that you will pay for their coverage while they're on a leave of absence, but your plan document won't allow you to do so. So could you do that? Yes,
yes.
But as an employer and outside of the plan document.
Got it. And to your point, Adam, is it possible that there might be someone who gets the handbook, who accepts employment based on those terms, but they're not a member of the health plan, so they've never even seen the plan document?
Right.
And yet you're telling them they're bound by this document they've never seen?
Right.
Again, I'm not going into the network.
All right, so let's get into the unwritten rules one. We got 20 minutes.
Now, this is not the only place where we're seeing an issue where you've got an employer saying one thing in their handbook and then something else in the plan document. Sometimes the employer is doing things or saying things that's neither in the handbook nor the plan document. This is where they're looking at a situation in a case-by-case basis. They're just making these decisions. You might have a situation where somebody, you know, they're having a tough time, something's happened, and the employer, you know, they've been a good employee for many years, and the employer says, you know what, let's give this person a leave of absence, you know, we'll keep them on the plan, we'll keep them salaried, you know, we're going to take care of them while they're gone for a few months. Meanwhile, their plan document says that if they're not working for more than a month, they're kicked from the plan. I hope they don't end up with a stop loss.
So, folks, just so you know, these are actual examples of cases we get.
Everything has happened. Every single
thing. So that first one, I can see that happening. As the employer, I can see, I go, you know what? Ron's having a tough time. Clearly, he needs a leave of absence. He obviously can't handle working for me anymore. I'm going to give the guy a break.
Breakdown.
Go to Mexico, Cancun for a month. I'm going to cover your benefits. But I might not actually, I'm not supposed to cover your benefits. Yet I am. You get a claim. Well, now my TPA is saying, Adam, you're not supposed to cover the benefits here.
That's right.
But I promised Ron I would. Mm-hmm. All right, well, if you pay it, stop loss is not going to reimburse you because even though they're mirroring the terms of the plan doesn't say you can do it.
That's right.
So what happens? I'm paying for that out of my own pocket.
You bet.
These are real things that happen. So sorry, Ron. Any other things?
Yeah, I mean, another example, this was a doozy, is you had someone, instead of being generous, was trying to be a little bit more tough with a difficult situation they were dealing with. They had a member who was seeking unspecified drug-seeking behavior. Basically, this person was going around to different physicians and facilities trying to get prescriptions, and when that provider would finally say, you know, I think there's a problem here, they'd move on to the next one. So eventually the employer said, listen, if you go to these providers, the only ones I'm willing to pay are these three that I've listed because these are the three who are aware of your condition and they know to take a hardline stance with you.
Right.
Well, the person said, well, forget that then. I'm going to go to somebody not on the list. The claims came in and they said, don't pay those claims with my self-funded plan. But there was nothing in the plan document that actually gave them a basis to exclude or deny these claims.
Right.
So either whether you're trying to be more generous with benefits or less generous with benefits, at the end of the day, whatever you do with benefits needs to be mirrored in the plan document.
So how about vendors, Ron? What do we see there?
This is another one, and if you get nothing else from this slide, take this. If you work with somebody who's looking to provide a service to your benefit plan, and they do not either ask to see your plan document or provide you with plan document language, run. Run in the other direction as fast as you can. Because every service I've ever seen a vendor provide either A, has to be supported by language already in the plan document, or B, requires a change to the plan document. You know, the example we like to use, because in some ways it's funny, it wasn't funny for these people, but it's funny for us to talk about it now, they actually, you know, the CEO was on an airplane, he's reading one of those Delta magazines, and he sees an article about this new thing, medical tourism. And you send somebody to Argentina for a knee replacement, and it's the greatest thing ever. So he goes back to his HR, and he says, ah, we gotta have this. They go and they find one of the medical tourism companies that was interviewed in the magazine. They sign all the contracts. First person signs up for a knee replacement. They put him on a plane to Argentina. They're at the resort. This is great. Claims come in. They want to pay with their plan, and there's an exclusion in the plan document for claims incurred outside the United States.
People think this is funny, but this happens all the time.
It's
a basic, simple thing that can be easily amended. That's not a big deal. The big one I'm seeing, obviously we know about the Medicare rates versus the UNC. That's been happening a lot,
right.
So we don't want to spend a lot of time on that.
Yeah.
But the one that is killing us right now as an industry is dialysis carve-out.
The carve-out.
The dialysis right now is the number one topic. Folks, if you have a claim right now with DaVita or Fresenius, where you're getting a letter from them or their attorneys from a claim from 2013 or 14 that says, hey, you paid me at Medicare plus 150. Your plan doc says Medicare 150. You follow the terms of your plan doc. That person walked into Fresenius with an ID card and a logo on it that has a national network. The national network is not paid at Medicare plus 140 or 150. It's a 20% discount. What's happening is these firms hire audit firms. These audit firms don't go in a month later or 2 months later. They go in 2 years later. And they're identifying claims where the provider has been underpaid. They are paid. These companies are paid, incentivized to find mistakes. They go, here, you were paid at Medicare 150. You should have been paid with a 20% in-network discount. 2 years later, guess what that means, Ron? Stop loss is gone.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
We have situation after situation. I have at least one a day. I know you get some of these. Brady, I'm not sure. Brady's not qualified to work on these tough stuff yet, is he?
He's on his way.
No, he's not, but he's not working on this hard stuff yet. But the bottom line is we get at least one a day. Where it's $1 million request with interest, with penalties, full bill charges. It happens all the time. And the first thing every TPA broker says to us is, the plan doc says, Medicare plus 150. I'm like, yeah, but are they in-network provider? Yes, they were. They were never actually carved out. If you have this situation and have not reached out to us, we're asking you nicely to reach out to us. We might be able to give you some free advice just to tell you, hey, this is what we think you should do. Or if it's not free, we'll tell you, hey, this is what the reality is, and what we think you should do is maybe negotiate. But we will give you feedback. Sorry, Ron, I know took over on that slide, but
no, you're right.
And I just wanted to make sure I brought that up. It's a major issue.
Interesting enough, when you talk about any kind of reference-based or Medicare-based pricing versus UNC or dialysis carve-out, the same answer applies to both, which is that if done properly, you can create a lot of savings. But if your plan document doesn't reflect the process is not done in accordance with the plan document, the ID card is not clear, the EOBs are not clear, if you don't take all the necessary steps, you will be burnt. But if you take all the proper steps, it's actually going to work.
What we're hearing now, and a lot of questions about this too, I'm assuming, is that can you just put it on the ID card or can you carve it out? If that network will let you do it, some will. But there are a lot of networks now that will not let you carve that out.
Right. There are multiple steps you need to
look at. Let's go on to the stop loss policy. That's a basic one. We see this all the time, but I can tell you folks, you might hear a big name. Just because it's a big name that everyone's heard of does not mean their policy is perfect. Trust me, there are certain policies where we will not do a gap review because we know it's a perfect policy. And we'll tell you that right off the bat. There's no charge. You just got to ask us. We won't answer that on the email, but we'll tell you that over the phone. But, again, a big issue. But the number one thing we're seeing here is the ADA leave rod.
Yeah, and I think that you've probably gotten from the entire webinar so far that there's this underlying threat of stop loss because, let's be honest, if somebody is on a leave of absence, they've been gone for 3 months, and the plan document says after 1 month, if you're not actively working, you should be kicked from the plan. That means they've been on the plan now for 2 months that they shouldn't have been. And let's say the person ends up incurring a few $100s in medical claims, and then they come back to work, and the plan pays the claims. No one's going to complain. Nobody's ever going to hear about it, and it's never going to be an issue. The problem is when somebody is out on leave for 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, according to the plan document, after 1 month without being actively at work, you should be kicked from the plan, and this person ends up with a catastrophic claim that goes to stop loss. Stop loss looks at the person, looks at the plan, and says, why were you still covering this guy? Is he on COBRA? No. Well, then why are you covering? Because he was on a leave of absence that we approved. Well, we didn't approve it. We cover the plan. The plan doesn't cover this. So that is the underlying issue, and that's really when these come to us is when there is a stop-loss problem. And when you look at examples like, for instance, ADA leave, a lot of the employers or the representative or whoever they're working with, maybe it's a disability.
Reasonable accommodation.
They talk about, oh, well, federal law requires that if this person is disabled, they need this time off. Oh, if this person is entitled to leave of absence based on the state law, right? We talked earlier about an Oregon law, or even Massachusetts, looking at our own handbook, their law. Yeah, I understand. But at the end of the day, stop loss ensures the plan. If the plan was silent on the matter, you're going to have a conflict. No one is saying the employer did anything wrong by covering the person. What the employer did wrong was not making sure that the plan document reflected what the law requires and giving stop loss a chance to cover it properly.
And don't forget, folks, there are many stop loss policies that actually give the stop loss carrier the right to interpret the terms of the plan. So even if you think you have discretion, you gave the stop loss carrier more discretion over your discretion to interpret the terms. So be really, really careful with that. I know the last one, Ron, we see this one all the time. We've been taught, this is the classic. This is the one that has been going on forever. It still goes on. And it's because of one stupid provision, usual and customary.
Yeah.
It kills us. Folks, if you are an employer or a TPA right now, look at the stop-loss policies to see if they have their own definition of UNC. And if it does, what does it say? And is it different than what your plan docs say? If so, you may have a problem.
The one thing I would ask every employer, because ultimately that's what this webinar is about employers. The one thing I would ask every employer to recognize or understand is that they do wear many hats, but they also represent multiple entities. There's the employer as the employer. There's the employer as the plan administrator. And ultimately, they could enter into separate, disparate, and conflicting relationships and find themselves in really hot water. You know, when an employer signs off on a network contract, when an employer signs on with a vendor, when an employer offers to give someone extended coverage out of the goodness of their heart or in accordance with a written handbook, the employer is acting as the employer. When the plan administrator reflects what the plan will and won't cover in its plan document and they secure stop loss, they're acting as the plan administrator. If those documents don't align, they're eventually going to be stuck between a rock and a hard place, and they can't go in those two opposite directions. And one of the areas that we see this all the time is the issue of UNC. An employer is at a conference, at an event. They hear about reference-based pricing. They hear about Medicare-based pricing. They love the idea. They want to do it. That's the employer speaking. But if the plan administrator is not on board and doesn't make adjustments to the plan document to match that intent, they're going to be burnt the first time a provider asks for a copy of the plan document. Second, if you're ambiguous, where everything isn't done in accordance with each other, meaning the vendor's process doesn't match the plan document, which doesn't match the employer's intent, then you may end up with an issue with stop loss. If you have ambiguous or vague language that can mean multiple things, and stop loss has the right to interpret the language independently, like Adam mentioned, they're going to read usual customary to mean one thing, and they're going to have their own auditors come in and reprice at less than what you paid.
Great points, Fraud. Back to you, Brady.
All right, so one of the best ways to look at an example of these complicated leaves is to actually just look at an actual state-based leave policy. And one of the most complicated ones and one of the most generous ones is from actually the state of Oregon. And so the example here, you can actually have a situation where a female employee can get up to 36 weeks of leave. So that's almost 9 months of leave. And there are very particular requirements that an employer must be aware of and the employee must meet in order to be eligible for that kind of leave. And it's very easy to make a mistake. A simple mistake alone will be enough to cause, you know, a break in coverage where stop-loss issues will come up. And so in one example here, a female employee can take 12 weeks of pregnancy leave, followed by 12 weeks of parental leave, followed by 12 more weeks of sick child leave. The key here is that there are certain requirements for each type of leave.
So let's again, another example, a real example.
Right.
So we had sick leave. That's expensive. The minute I hear the word there was sick leave for a child, mm-hmm. I'm assuming spec claim.
Mm-hmm.
Stop loss.
Yep.
So this is a stop loss issue because of this, right? So sorry, Brady. I just wanted to make sure. This is real. I mean,
yeah, these are real claims. This
so
is a real example.
That's a great example. I mean, this is obviously hundreds of thousands of dollars, not millions.
Right, and in this case, the employer was supposed to keep track of the dates, which they did, to the letter T. The problem was that part of the sick leave, the sick child leave requirement, is that care must be provided for the child at home. And in this case, the child was still actually admitted in the hospital. And so, you know, that's something that you could easily miss. And in this case, you know, there was a problem where that was missed. Coverage should not have been extended for that last 12-week period. A bunch of claims are incurred in that period. Stop loss catches the issue. And then we've got a big problem.
So stop loss doesn't want to reimburse.
Correct.
But the employer now is on the hook.
Correct.
And the reason the employer bought stop loss is because they don't want to go bankrupt.
Correct. And, you know, they missed this little part of the law here that says you have to be at home with a child. And you know, it's
– As an owner of a company, if I'm a TPA on this phone, these employers – or if I'm a broker, these employers, folks, will leave you after this happens. It's not just it's a big claim, oh, well. That employer is now saying – one, I could sue somebody because I got advice from you, broker, TPA, or two, you didn't tell me I couldn't do this.
Yep.
And three, why in the world am I ever going to be self-funded again? I'm going to be fully insured now. So it's not just a claim issue. It changes the behavior of that broker, that TPA, that employer group, who gets sued, who doesn't get sued, etc. This is the kind of thing that for, you know, we're talking about under $1,000, this all could have been caught ahead of time before you had $1 million in claims.
Adam, do you think politicians who oppose self-funding and are afraid that small and medium employers can't afford to self-fund, you think that this would not necessarily be the flag that they're going to wave when
we
talk about this?
Of course. So,
yeah, it's a good example. And we said earlier on that leaves of absence are the most important thing. Here's why. I mean, in this case, it's a very complicated, very detailed law, and there are other states. I mean, California has something like 20 leaves of absence, and it's very complicated to keep track of all of them. But thankfully, we're very great at doing that. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jen.
Jen, I know there are a couple questions that were asked. They were very similar type of questions. You want to maybe give a little response in regards to the network adequacy issue?
Yeah, so there was a question about whether or not a plan could, is required to have any sort of qualifications for a claim that was incurred within a certain distance or a certain area. And the answer to that is it really depends on what reasonable means to you. And yes, you can certainly, and probably there's something in the network agreement that says for an in-network specialist within a certain area, if it's within this area, then yes, it needs to be covered. But without of that area, then it might depend on what your contract says and also how your plan caveats what that distance or that radial is in the first place.
Great answer. I also want to bring up those questions, a couple of questions in regards to broker liability on the gaps in coverage, if there's a stop-loss gap in coverage. It's not my opinion. This court case all over the country that have said, if the broker is the one selling, helping to sell the policy, if the broker gets a commission, if the broker placed somebody placed that stop-loss carrier with that employer just didn't do it on their own. No employee picks up the phone and calls Sun Life or calls Gerber or calls one of these companies and says, hey, I want stop-loss. Somebody advised them. So the question is, yes, the broker is potentially liable if, or the TPA, depending on, one, if they were the ones that were hired. In many situations, the TPA is not responsible for who the broker brings in for stop-loss. We see that all the time, too. It depends on the situation, but the answer to that question is, of course. Jen, inconsistent administration. What do we see here in the few minutes we have left?
All right, I'll try and be brief. So this is an issue that has arisen time and time again, but it's important that we remember that ERISA is what governs us, and the plan document is determining what it is that would be applicable from a fiduciary perspective for the plan administrator. So the plan administrator has a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that the plan document is not only compliant, but is being administered in a uniform manner. So as a couple of examples here, you are not, even if your language is crystal clear, there's no issue about how to interpret the language, there's no ambiguity, but as a plan administrator, you make the decision to pay a claim for someone, but to deny a very similar claim for somebody else because of their relationship to the CEO or because of any other similar issues, it would be really unfortunate because that claim would most likely be overturned in the future because you are setting a bad precedent and you are potentially abusing your discretion as a fiduciary responsibility in paying outside the terms of the plan or paying differently. The next one is talking about the source of injury rule. So this has been a issue that has arisen pretty recently, too. There are in our exclusion section, specifically in our FIA documents, that there is a caveat that says that if there was a claim that was incurred as a result of domestic violence or a health condition, that that would be accepted from being an exclusion. So it's important to realize that there are other benefits that could potentially impact how you would decide whether or not that caveat would come into play. So an example here, a member overdoses on narcotics and requires expensive treatment. The FPD is denying claims that are caused by the illegal drugs. Remember that there is a difference for something that was incurred because of a medical or health condition or domestic violence. So just because there is a claim that is arising when it is illegal, like a car accident, like a DUI type car accident, if that occurred for some other reason, you may need to look at the underlying caveat and even in the first place make sure that your plan document references the source of injury rule in the first place, because if it doesn't, that's potential compliance problem.
We're getting a lot of questions about the leave of absence service that we're offering. It's going to be called a leave of absence service, okay, and it's going to be based on a flat rate where we can compare leave of absence in certain states versus what your plan doc says. That should be coming out within a week. With full disclosure, this was an idea that Brady had, so I want to give credit where credit's due. But we also have a question in regards to just overall, how do people get access to our legal services and compliance? It's called ICE. Pretty simple. It's a PEPM fee. All these questions and then some are answered every single month without any invoicing. It's one invoice flat fee per month. And you get access to Jen, Brady, Ron, and myself as an offering as you want. But Jen, I know you have one last slide before we're done here, and that ties into what employers must be aware of, some of the laws.
Yeah, so the quick thing that I'll go over here is that this is important when it comes to rehiring employees. So under the Affordable Care Act right now, there are certain rehire rules that need to be complied with if you are subject to the employer mandate and you don't wish to pay a penalty. It's possible that when you're looking at the federal laws or whatever your leave of absence policies could be, that there is a potential rule for how you should handle an employee who is a temporary employee or an employee who was laid off or there was some other situation where they're temporarily not at work. And it's possible that those rehire rules could be different because of a state or federal law than what is currently in your plan document. So front to back, the leave of absence issue has been a big issue where there have been a lot of failure to get reimbursed on claims that we think a quick review of the benefits, the documents in advance could prevent a lot of these issues from arising in the first place.
So reach out to us if you have any questions. So with that, I'm going to end it today, guys. I think we got to a lot of questions. We will reach out to all you folks who have contacted us. As always, please email us at pgcreferral@theagroup.com to reach out to us. Our next webinar is going to be on March 23rd, 2017 at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It's going to be about providers and facilities. We're going to talk about negotiation tactics, what you could do in balanced billing. Balanced billing does not only occur on reference-based pricing plans. It occurs on any out-of-network or no-network plan, regardless if it's reference-based or not. There's a lot of it. We're going to talk about how to recoup overpayments. As they say, once a provider has the money, it's hard to get that money back. But I promise you, every single webinar for the rest of this month will include Brady talking about the Trump transition or what the administration's doing. It's going to talk about Jen, what's happening in our, when it comes to the regulations, all the stuff that we're seeing with the stop loss carriers, what's trending that particular month. And you'll always get Ron's rants. Ron loves to, God, if we did a video of this just watching Ron and the faces he makes, I'm scared to sit next to him when he's talking. It's pretty exciting. But we'll, again, on behalf of Ron, Jen, Brady, and myself, thank you to the hundreds and thousands of you that dial in every single month. We hope you tune into our podcast. Go to feagroup.com. See you next time. Thank you.